and welcome to Against the Law, the ancient history podcast that aims to separate fact from fiction in the ancient world. Today we're continuing our reception series with a whole new topic and an exciting guest today. This series, the podcast team is sharing with me their favourite or most interesting takes on ancient stories. And for this episode, we had a rather novel idea. Yeah, that's right, we're covering novels. We'll be covering them, in fact, from cover to cover. Then I'll be making notes along the way and deciding which of the pitches sounds best to me. Let's hope they don't find it too hard back in the recording studio. Yeah, anyway, leafing through the ancient Romans, we've got Xenia, calling her by her title. We've got Dr. Meg here to cover the ancient Greeks. We have Barney, who's an open book when it comes to the ancient Near East. And we're joined by the textbook perfect guest, Professor May Monsieur, who is here to share her knowledge and expertise. I'm Flo, and normally my mind is in the gutter, which that's actually a really niche book-related joke. But now I'm ready to grow a spine and hear some pitches from the team about ancient history and novels.
Hello, May. We're really, really glad to have you joining us. If you don't mind, could you introduce yourself for us? Give us a little intro on you and what you do.
Absolutely. It's a pleasure to be here in the Against the Law podcast studio. Thank you so much for having me. I'm May Monsieur. I am an ancient historian and a public engagement professional. And what that means is basically I've got one foot in academia and another foot in the so-called real world. I do lots of work around ancient history and trying to bring it alive to modern audiences. But then I also work around communities and public engagement and all sorts of things relating to the arts and cultural spaces and how they sort of work with the outside world in order to, get them interested in the kind of work that we do at the university or universities, because at the moment I'm working across the School of Advanced Study, Oxford University and Swansea University, doing different kind of things with respect to supporting research impact and public engagement. And then across the time and space, I tend to do a lot of talk around, well, basically getting the ancient world, you know, interested in the modern audience and vice versa.
I'm really glad you've mentioned about modern audiences, because today I think we're going to talk about a combination of modern and ancient audiences, aren't we? Xenia, can you give us a nutshell on what you four are going to be pitching to me today?
So today we are going to be talking about novels. Novels that are written now and set in the ancient world. So I read a few different novels that were kind of set around the turn of the end of the Republic in ancient Rome. Robert Harris has written a very famous Cicero trilogy where he kind of charts Cicero's political career, and the context in which that happens historically is quite like fraught with lots of political developments in Rome in general, not just in his career. So that's really interesting. But it is, you know, he does kind of make up the characters, he riffs on the characters, even though it's set in a particular ancient time. So that's what we are going to be bringing to the table today.
Fabulous. Okay, well, I'm excited, and I'm very excited to have you here, May, as our guest. So Xenia, you've just mentioned about modern audiences responding to sort of takes on ancient literature, but weren't there ancient audiences as well? May, maybe you could tell us more about that.
I would be delighted to. I did my studies, my MA particularly, and then PhD on the ancient novels. And these are incredibly exciting piece of fiction, narrative fiction in prose. Not very many people know about them, even within the classical world. In classical scholarship, know very much about them. So we're always having to fight our case. But these ancient novels, I suppose in some sense, they are quite different from epic, like Homer's Trojan War and, you know, sort of the Odyssey, different from tragedy and different from myth and different from, you know, sort of legends. So they're different kind of stories. However, they do take a bit from everything that I've just said. And it came about in a sense, I suppose, if we were going to put some sort of time frame between the 1st century AD and the 4th century AD. So this, in order to put a picture in audience's mind, is a time post Alexander the Great, where you've got the Hellenistic world going global. You've got all these kind of cultural, linguistic melting pots. And then you've got the sort of, you know, expanding Roman Empire as well. So you've got that growth of this kind of empire worlds, where the two are meeting. And then you've got this kind of exciting cultural exchanges happening, as well as political and social and economic. And in that kind of melting pot, you've got some literary explorations and literary innovation. So the ancient novel comes to be. And there is a whole heap of them, but obviously there isn't very much that survives. Now, some of the themes, I mean, there are some characteristic themes in a lot of the novels. So a young hero and heroine who are usually elite or well-born and they're beautiful, and they're about to get married or will be getting married, but this is disrupted and they're separated. And there's travel involved to distant parts. So whether it's Egypt, Persia, you've got, you know, sort of modern day Turkey, etc. All very exciting stuff. And then a series of unfortunate events happen. And this is where it gets really exciting. You've got pirates. You've got love struck Persian kings. You've got ghosts and witches and gender bending. And, and misidentification and even bestiality. Okay, so I mean, you've got the whole bag. And then on top of that, you also got this, like with some of the novels, you've got a really central theme in virginity and chastity, which won't surprise you if you're thinking about ancient world, well, even to some sense our modern world. So sometimes those the virginity and chastity becomes a very central theme. Now there's also our first, what we would consider a science fiction novel too, which is very exciting because people didn't think they were being written in the first or second century AD, right? So that's quite exciting.
So cool.
Yeah, I mean, it, you know, where you've got, it's Lucian's A True Story, and it's a kind of ironic novel because he tells you, right, you know, I'm going to tell you a lot of lies, but this one is true and you've got to believe me. And it's like, okay, dude. Okay, so you go into it with a kind of sense of, do I believe this guy or not? And so, and he talks about intergalactic warfare between the sun and the moon people. And, you know, it's really incredible stuff. But the core of the corpus of the novels tend to concentrate on this love and adventure romances. And I guess what we have surviving are some texts and fragments that we have these core authors. So we have the earliest, the sort of first century AD, Ninus, and this is a kind of from the ancient East, Near East, a story of a king and a queen. And we've got a kind of love story happening there, but we only get fragments of it. And then the core of Greek romance authors were Chariton of Aphrodisias, which is, you know, sort of in modern day Turkey. And then you've got Xenophon of Ephesus, again, in that kind of bordering Turkey land, and Achilles Tatius of Alexandria in Egypt. We've got Heliodorus, who calls himself the Phoenician from Syria, and Longus, who's from Greek. So you've got this kind of like a wide sort of birth of authors who represent the different, you know, sort of cultural spaces that the Greco-Roman world has now become. So, and then you have two Latin novels, which some of you may know, Petronius's Satyricon and Apuleius's Metamorphoses. And then you've got other romances like the Alexander Romance, which charts the constructed history of Alexander the Great and what happens after and before. and then the story of Apollonius, king of Tyre. And then you've got a Babylonian story, and you've got another story, which is a fantastical tale called Wonders Beyond Thule. And sometimes that is, you know, sort of in modern context, often described like this kind of Scandinavian world, possibly Iceland, etc. And then you've got Lucian's A True Story. And so what you're getting is this kind of range of really exciting body of work, ranging from all the different countries that are, you know, sort of incorporated into this, well, imperial world. We'll call it the imperial age, the Roman Empire.
That just sounds like a really exciting moment in time. I often daydream about when I'd want to time travel back to, and it just sounds like a fantastic melting pot of cultures that you've mentioned earlier. But also, as a sci-fi nerd myself, I really love that there's the original sci-fi novel. That sounds fantastic. So very, very excited to hear everyone's pitches now after May's amazing and fabulous introduction. Meg, I'm going to pick on you first to do the first pitch of the day. So could you tell me what you've brought to me for my delectation?
Absolutely, an honour to do the first pitch of the day. I was actually thinking, it was really interesting that May mentioned the Alexander romances in terms of ancient novels. And one of the things I wanted to pitch is actually also basically Alexander novels. And there is a writer called Mary Reno, who is a really, really interesting person, really interesting life, kind of a queer icon, which is cool, and basically moved to South Africa and started writing sort of fairly gay fiction set in the ancient world. And one of her most famous books, or it's actually a trilogy, is about the life of Alexander the Great. And it's so, so good. I read it when I was a teenager and I haven't reread it since, but I think I'm based off the back of this, I'm going to listen to my own pitch and definitely reread. It's like really beautifully written. And it just kind of goes through the whole story of Alexander, a few different kind of perspectives on it, different bits of his life. And it takes it you right up from his sort of childhood, which is just so, so interesting. And I think one of the things that we're sort of talking about historical novels, like ancient novels set in sort of historical time periods this time, rather than mythical retellings, I feel like that's kind of how we've distinguished this from the last episode. And one of the things that is so amazing about these novels set in ancient time periods and kind of real ancient time periods rather than mythological ones is that they give you a sense of how it felt to be in the world, I think. And there's all these sort of descriptions, like sensory descriptions, that Mary Reno includes, which just literally transport you. They take you straight back. Well, they don't literally transport you, that was a huge exaggeration, but they do take you there. And interestingly, there aren't many Greek ones. And I would be interested to see what other people think about this. I found way more, just sort of doing the research for this episode, way more Roman fiction set in Roman times. And I think it might be because of the Roman Empire, because of the amount of sort of evidence we have for that, it's easier to imagine that, get that sort of sensory experience of, you know, what plates did they use? What did things smell like? And it seems to be lacking a little bit in Greece. So anyway, that's my pitch. But yes, also interested in that, about why there is that lack.
I've got to agree with you, Meg. I really love it when you can really conjure up an image of the place that's being described, like you mentioned, the smells and the sounds. I really like, previously we've had our lovely guest and friend Caroline Lawrence on, and she's really evocative with her descriptions of how things really would have felt. And I think for me, especially as someone who doesn't have an education in the classics, that really conjures up a very special and vibrant image. I really love that.
I was thinking about the exact same thing, Flo, about Caroline and about that sort of sensory experience. Also, my memory of one of the ancient, or the only one of the ancient novels May mentioned that I've read, is the Apuleius one. And in my memory of that, and it could be completely wrong, there is a scene in which some witches wee on somebody, like urinate on someone. And that's a sensory experience that the book captures for you. So maybe it was a factor in the ancient novels as well.
I love that we're only a few minutes in, we've talked about bestiality, pirates and weeing on people. It's a real shocker of an episode, this one, slightly unexpectedly. May, you spoke about a Babylonian story, and I think that one thing that we've had underrepresented in this season, and poor Barney has bore the brunt of this, is a lack of ancient Near Eastern representation. Now, Barney, I'm curious. Are you curious to hear about this Babylonian novel?
Yes, Although I assume it's set in Babylonia, right, rather than of Babylonian origin.
You're certainly right, Barney. You can see there are some influences from the ancient Near East, but it is basically novelists who are part of that sort of Greco-Roman world. So Ambilicus, who wrote the Babylonian story, he's an ancient Syrian Greek novelist. So in that sense, he's tapping into both his Greekness and Syrian, but then writing about a story that is a Babylonian construct, right?
Interesting. And what is the story? Is it one you know well?
Well, it's one that I don't really know very well, but then I don't think very many people do, because there's only fragments of it. So we only get a really, really tiny bit. But so Ambilicus, the author, he kind of reached fame in the second century. And, you know, he spoke at least three languages, Assyrian, Babylonian, and Greek. And he was educated in Babylon. And so you could see that he's been very much influenced by that as well. And so basically, the novel is about two lovers, Rhodanes and Sinonis. And you've got Gamus, who is the legendary king of Babylon, who forces Sinonis to marry him and then throws Rhodanes into prison. And then the two lovers, they manage to escape, and they have lots and lots of adventures, just like the core kind of Greek novels that we know a bit more about. And there is a considerable magic that plays a part in it. And then finally, the king is overthrown by Rhodanes and then becomes king of Babylon. Basically, it's about 39 books, but basically, by the time we get it, we only get a few fragments of the original work. So that's why it's a very sort of abridged version of what actually happened.
39 books. That is incredible. That's the most epic of all the series we've pitched to flow ever. That's amazing.
It's like the sort of fan fiction kind of length, right?
Yeah, you've got to take some of these things with a pinch of salt, because with a lot of ancient works, sometimes they come through to us after being, you know, sort of transmitted through different ages. And so, you know, one body of work called the Suda mentions 39 books, but then Photius later down the line says, well, there may only have been 17. So, you know, in a sense, you've got to just take things with a slight pinch of salt when it comes to sort of the evidence. Yeah.
I guess what's interesting about that is that it suggests to me that, I know you said that the author had sort of Greek and Syrian heritage. So sort of thinking back to an earlier, like, imagined past of the rough area in which he was raised. But yeah, I think the sheer length of that, and the fact that, you know, I don't recognize any of those names, like Gamus, I've never heard that name, you know, like, from any sort of ancient Near Eastern sources. And you do really get the impression that it's this sort of like ancient fan fiction, almost like exoticizing this slightly unusual, unfamiliar past in the area.
Yeah, you're absolutely right. I mean, in a sense, you are getting a kind of voyeuristic fantasy of what the Near East is like, you know? So centuries and centuries, the Greeks were absolutely repelled but also fascinated by the ancient Near East.
It's that's exactly what you're describing. It's so familiar to me, but from like sort of Victorian novels as well, or like early 20th century novels. It's so interesting to see that sort of orientalization and exoticization that I think we associate with a lot later European literature happening in the ancient world as well.
Well, you can see the legacy, you can see the afterlife of these ancient novels. Firstly, in the kind of Byzantine period, and then you get the Renaissance period. And then you get into the kind of modern works. You know, you've got your Samuel Richardson Pamler, you've got your Thomas Hardy, and, you know, and then you get your Victorian stuff. And so, and then you get The Great Gatsby. So The Great Gatsby is very much a sort of a parallel to Petronius' Satyricon, and, you know, the excess and the over consumption of luxury and wealth, etc., represented in the 20s is also what Petronius writes in the Satyricon in reference to the Nero age, and what Tom Wolfe write in the 80s on Bonfire of the Vanities, right? The yuppie era and this kind of excess. And so what you're getting is this kind of long shadow, this long legacy of the ancient novelists, these creation of these different worlds, which now, you know, are become a kind of staple to, I suppose, when we're reading, you know, sort of these modern novels, that, you know, what you're realizing is that this is actually has an incredibly long legacy.
Yeah, that's so phenomenal. I never figured that connection between Petronius' Satyricon and The Great Gatsby, and I'm just like, oh, of course, it does make sense. Wow. Yeah, that I guess The Great Gatsby is kind of sadder, maybe less funny. I find the Satyricon very funny, but yeah, that's amazing. I've learned so much today.
This is so great for reception to like trace it from the source to now. So cool.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. One thing that I found out a couple of years ago, is that Daphnis and Chloe, which is a novel by Longus, and it's a very beautiful, I mean, there's not very much traveling abroad for the adventure. Everything happens within the country, and there's this play between country and city. And it's just about this young couple, very young, and it's this kind of emergence, their discovery of erotic love and their sexuality, right? And there was a translation of it, I think it was the sort of 19th century, I can't remember who it was, and that was the basis of The Princess Bride.
No way! That's amazing!
I know.
That's so, so great. We've been having so many fun discoveries this series of things which are sort of like finding out things that are surprisingly classics. And that is a fantastic one to add to the list. I love that.
That is amazing. Was it called Daphnis and Chloe? I think I might have to look that up. I know that wasn't technically a pitch, May, but that appeals to me far more than other erotic novels in recent years. Coming off talking about Babylonians and their, 39-part stories, which might be a bit much. Barney, I'm going to come to the Ancient Near East. I'm coming to you next. Could you share with me your pitch, please?
Yes. So, predictably, I have not necessarily been able to bring a book, a modern fiction work set in the ancient Near East, unfortunately. I'm sure I could have found one, but then I would have had to have lied, because I certainly haven't read one. I don't believe that they've graced any bestseller lists at any point in the last few years. But I just wanted to give a tiny little bit of context, partly because I mentioned the Victorian literature earlier, and then also partly to say that in the context of the ancient world, whilst there wasn't really anything that looks anything like a novel in the ancient Near East, you know, a lot of the sort of the narratives that we have from the Akkadian language, like the Epic of Gilgamesh or the creation myth, Enuma Elish, those are poems. So whilst they have the narrative structure that we might see anticipating something like a novel many years later, they are sort of, they're technically poems. But Egypt has sort of some narrative tales as well, which maybe look a little bit like later novels. I don't know if anyone at school learned that Robinson Crusoe is held to be one of the sort of the first modern type novels. But ancient Egypt has the tale of the shipwrecked sailor, which is a nice long narrative about somebody who is predictably shipwrecked. But there's fantastical elements in that as well. So yeah, we've got a bit of anticipating the kind of narratives that you might see in novels in the ancient Near East and Egypt. But yeah, so then to pick up what I said on Victorian literature, I thought it was interesting what May was saying about the orientalization, because I think that's something that we know that happens a lot in the 19th century, of treating the sort of the exotic East as other. And obviously, you know, Egyptomania and the discovery of Tutankhamun very much contributed to that sort of thing in the early 20th century. And so we have adventure books like those of H. Rider Haggard, who wrote King Solomon's Mines, which I will absolutely not be pitching today, despite some of them. For example, the brilliantly named The Ancient Alan, having some basis in the ancient...
just rewrite quickly. The Ancient Alan.
The Ancient Alan. Yeah, I don't know if any of you have read King Solomon's Mines.
No.
The main character that Rider Haggard dreamed up was called Alan Quatermain, A-L-L-A-N.
This is a Paul Atreides all over again.
Exactly. And so in the second of those books, so King Solomon's Mines is about the search for the biblical Solomon's Mines. The second of those books is called She, and it's about an extremely exoticized, ridiculously sexualized, like horrible portrayal of this ancient Misc African queen who sort of comes back to life. And then in the third one, which is The Ancient Alan, it's an ancient pharaoh, or the descendant of a pharaoh who is one of the agents of the narrative. So yeah, we don't love those at all. If they're pretty old fashioned adventure books. But all that said, and all those as given reasons, is basically a very long excuse as to why I'm not able to bring an ancient Near Eastern set novel to you today. So I will instead be bringing one set in ancient Rome.
Okay, that's exciting.
Yep. So the book that I'm bringing that's set in ancient Rome is called The Ides of March by an American author called Thornden Wilder. And what I find interesting about The Ides of March, which was released in the middle of the 20th century, is that it's presented as a series of letters. And I think, you know, Zenny has mentioned a few times recently the letters of, you know, elder Roman statesmen like Pliny. Did we talk about Pliny's letters last time, Zenny?
Yeah, we didn't dwell on his letters too much in the end. But yeah, in relation to, he's a character in Caroline Lawrence's children's series. So that's in the context in which we mentioned him. But yeah, he did write a lot of letters, very, very valuable historical sources.
Well, there we go. And so I think that because letters have been so important to the reconstruction of parts of Roman history, it's interesting that Thornden Wilder chose to present his novel as a series of letters between Julius Caesar, hence the Ides of March, which is when he is murdered. Well, the whole of the Ides of March builds up to the assassination of Julius Caesar. And so what's nice is that you have historical characters like Mark Antony and Caesar and Cleopatra. But it's not historical. In fact, I think Thornden Wilder calls it a fantasia. So it's sort of an imagining of what was going on around that time, and he's giving voice to these characters. But what I really like about it is that one of the correspondents in these letters, which are presented as, you know, dozens of documents throughout the book, is Cleopatra herself. And so I have been able to get a tiny little bit of Egypt in here, because what I remember really enjoying about it when I read it years ago is the fact that Cleopatra has a voice. And that she is not just sort of the object of this battle between Caesar and Mark Antony. She's an agent in the novel in her own right. And, you know, it's a fairly positive representation of her. Obviously, part of the book does cover her sexual liaisons with both Caesar and Mark Antony. But it's also very complimentary of her. And as I said, she writes her own letters in it. And so Thornden Wilder has imagined what her voice would be like. But it's just, I enjoyed seeing that representation as an Egypt fan.
Yay, finally, some Cleo time.
That is so cool. I love that about the letters, that format giving Cleopatra a voice. Also, just a quick shout out to another fantastic Roman novel, another fantastic novel set in Rome, which is John Williams' Augustus, which is also told in letters or epistolary. And that is, I think that's the 70s. So there was clearly a little boom going on because that's when Mary Renault was as well. But yeah, fantastic book. That would be my second pitch if I was allowed a second pitch.
Oh, nice. Yeah, I didn't mention the date of The Ides of March, but it's 1948, I think.
That is cool. I really enjoy the format of letters because it affords the author the possibility of writing in different voices, which I think sounds really fun to do practically. And is it enjoyable for the reader as well?
I'm just finding it really interesting that a lot of everyone's favourite books are not necessarily like super, super recent ones, are kind of more sort of mid-20th century, late 20th century writers. because I've got a couple of pitches coming up. I've already mentioned Robert Harris's trilogy. He's an excellent thriller writer, and I do love a lot of his other work as well. I didn't massively enjoy the Cicero trilogy, but I think it's very dense and it's very political, and I kind of found myself getting a little bit lost in the mess of the late Republic. But he's also written one set in Pompeii, which is actually really good. That's a proper sort of page turner. That's his more traditional style of thriller. I've got an anti pitch for you, which is sort of like the grown up Caroline Lawrence in a way, in that it's another detective series set in the Roman Empire. A lot of my friends really loved it. I hated it. I absolutely could not stand it. It is just as well that I read the book during lockdown. Otherwise, I don't think I would have finished it. Nothing about like the world building. The world building's great. It's lovely. But the main character is just a despicable person. And the writing style, I find really grating. I find really frustrating. And the author uses far too many semicolons. And if there's if there's one thing
that's such that a niche criticism, I totally get you, I completely agree,
they're so overused right, like at the moment, because people think they're smart by using a semicolon. It's like, it's grammatically incorrect, mate, just leave it out.
How do you feel about the M dash, the big dash?
I love it.
Similar. Oh, okay. Controversial.
But that's
interesting.
We need to start a new podcast where you can tell us your views on like the Oxford comma and semicolons and all of these different topics. But I really like the concept of an anti-pitch. You've got me intrigued.
Thank you. I had to get my view out there. However, one big pitch that I do want to do that is very much in line with the kind of vibe of Barney and Meg's previous pitches is I, Claudius. It's an absolute classic. It was made into a BBC series. Of course it was. And it's magic. It's really phenomenal storytelling. So that's kind of written from the perspective of the Emperor Claudius and him trying to navigate all of these different powers that are trying to influence him, from his wife to like his stepson and all of these different We talked about Claudius quite a bit before, didn't we, about the possibility that he might have been autistic. Now, obviously, the book isn't kind of written from that angle. But when you do consider that as well, you know, he as a character becomes so very nuanced and actually very vulnerable. He tends to be ridiculed by Roman historians who write, you know, about 100 years or so later. But I think he's just such a phenomenal and really deep and interesting character. And this is a book that starts trying to sort of give credit to that side of him.
Absolutely. So it's that time in the episode where we come to choose our favourite things. And since, May, you're our guest, I think I'm going to do the polite thing and let you go first and choose which of these pictures to you makes you want to go away and read something. Which one are you going to go for?
Okay, so you might see this as a cop-out, to my shame, I have not read Mary Renault. And I think the way that it has been described, I mean, I've, you know, sort of know the context and, you know, obviously Mary has written so many, but I'm just completely sort of, one, the fact that I think I really do need to, but two, you know, description is just so beautifully used here. So yeah, I think that's going to and also I quite like the queer gender bending kind of scenario there, so
it is a good choice. Today's episode is tough, I have to say. Meg, I'm gonna go to you next. What is your pitch that you're gonna go to interact with next?
I think it should be obvious to everyone it's going to be The Ancient Alan.
Of course.
It will.
No, that was an anti-pitch.
No, I'm joking. I am obviously going to go and read the ancient science fiction novel. That sounds so cool. I hope there's a good translation, or at least I'm going to go and look at it up on Wikipedia. That sounds amazing.
It does sound good. I'm quite drawn to Daphnis and Chloe. That sounds like a really, really interesting plot. I'm gonna interact with that, I think. Okay, right, so Barney, I'm gonna come to you next. What has made you think, ooh, I must read that?
Well, in terms of both sort of achievability and my own excitement, I think I've got to try and track down a translation of the fragments of the Iamblichus's Babyloniaca, because maybe 39 books might have been a bit daunting if it still existed. But since May's explained that it only exists in fragments, I think it would be very manageable. And since it's about, since it's set in some sort of fantasy version of historic Babylon, then I would love to commit to reading those fragments, even if it only takes 15 minutes.
Barney, maybe you could fill in the gaps that are missing. There might be a gap in the market for you to fill with that.
Yes, the Barney-Oniaca, I think.
Yeah, that's it. Yeah, very catchy.
That's very good.
And Senya, what was your favourite pitch from today?
Well, I want to read Barney's ancient Egyptian shipwreck person story. I think that sounds really, really like fun.
I can really recommend The Tale of the Shipwrecked Sailor to you, Senya. I think you'd enjoy it. There's some quite modern sensibilities in there.
Fun.
As a fan of Robinson Crusoe and Swiss Family Robinson, that has me intrigued too. My favourite pitch from today is going to be The Ides of March. I think I'm going to go away with Barney's suggestion and I'm going to go and look it up, because I can always catch I, Claudius on the telly, can't I? That will save my eyes. I'm going with The Ides of March for my favourite pitch. But all of them were amazing and fantastic, and I'm really excited in reality to go and interact with all of those things. Before we go, May, would you like to let us know a little bit about what you're up to at the moment?
Okay, yes. So we're doing a reimagining of three stories, three black voices from myth, Memnon and Andromeda and Chariclea, and modern Ethiopian Eritrean communities, and talking about migration and forced exile. So this is part of the Institute of Classical Studies fellowship project. So do check it out on our website.
That sounds very interesting. So you can find links to those on our Twitter. And thanks everybody for an awesome episode. I can already hear my bookshelves groaning. And you can catch us next time for Against the Law.